evening, you all. I'm K2, Romeo, India Whiskey. You'll also hear Kilo 2, Kilo, Echo, Yankee. His name is Mel, my name is Dick. Mel's the former president of the Kings County Radio Club. I've never been a member of, held such a position. But the two of us try to organize the technical net. We try to be the host, the net control. And we claim that this is an educational process, that for those who are willing to listen, something can be learned. There's a lot of brain power in the New York City tri-state area, and we try to tap into that. Hams come together on this particular net. They have been doing that now for 28 and a half years, starting in September of 1982. This is TechNet number 1,351, would you believe? So the guys have been coming together, asking each other questions. How does all this stuff work, and how to make it work better? What's really going on inside of a transmission line, a waveguide, a horn antenna, a Yagi antenna, a dipole antenna? How does my transmitter do that? How does my receiver do that? And so on. What does the standing wave ratio meter really tell me? There's an awful lot to learn about electronics. Radio electronics, RF electronics, wireless electronics. Unfortunately, the schools do only a mediocre job of teaching that art and science. The way they teach it is not necessarily easily applicable to the real world. A person becomes an RF engineer, an RF maven, by about a 10-year apprenticeship. You've got to be working for a company or working with a person who has that knowledge and is willing to convey it to you. If you're one of those lucky people, or quite a few people, a big percentage of their radio knowledge came from their ham radio experience, talking to their fellow ham radio operators, getting together in groups like this, doing experiments in the backyard, in the basement, really building antennas, hands-on experience. That's where it comes from. You touch the thing and you see the thing and you learn it a hell of a lot faster than when somebody just gives you a bunch of equations on a board or you read an article in a book. Although there are some very good books on the subject, although it takes an awful lot of books to really learn wireless as well. The TechNet, I'll tell you what the menu is like. I take check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment. After 28 and a half years, you don't have to sign in saying you're listening. By now, we believe that. We save a little bit of time by doing it that way. We make a promise that we usually keep, but not always, that within the first hour, we try to get to everyone who checked in the beginning with at least a brief answer. That's followed by, at 9 o'clock, Mel opens his mailbag of the newer amateurs that have questions and they don't yet have a license, and the way of communicating with us is by way of email or snail mail, and they ask questions. We try to answer at least a few of those that are of the general nature. If there is something going on interesting in space, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, tells us what NASA has been doing. And NASA is doing some very interesting things these days. And then after that, we get into the deeper subjects, which doesn't please everybody. But you don't have to listen to it if you don't want to. As I've said in the past, if you just sit and listen, even though the stuff may sound a little bit too deep to you, you don't have to understand everything. When you go to a college class, let me drop. One of the things you learn in your freshman year is that a high percentage of what you're going to hear the first time doesn't make sense. It's hard to understand. It's difficult to put it all together, so to speak. That is the normal learning process. If you don't know something and you don't know what you don't know, it's going to be uncomfortable in the beginning. All learning is a little bit uncomfortable depending on your attitude. And that's kind of normal. If you sit and listen to the buzzwords and you listen to the explanations, even though they don't make sense at first, in time they will. That's the normal learning process. If you expect every single person giving you a lecture to make it comfortable and fun on every single thing you're going to learn, well, you've got an over-expectation. The real world's not like that. That's a little bit of a philosophy. Also, don't be afraid, just because we sometimes get into some ridiculously deep questions, don't be afraid to ask a so-called dumb question. There is no such thing as a dumb question. A dumb question represents a bigger gulf between a bigger spacing between what the person knows and what he would like to know. And so the so-called dumb questions are the ones that are, in many cases, most deserving of an answer. Only an elitist and snobby person will say, hey, that question is not up to our standards and we're not going to answer it. We don't do that. Mel and I don't do that. I'm going to say check-ins at this time. Give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which confirms the fact that you do have a question or a comment for the net. K2RIW listening.
WHRYY. Joe.
Yes. We certainly have Joe. And I don't even have to ask. I know that Rich and 2EO, the former WB2TCC, he also is going to check in tonight. So we got Joe and Rich. Anyone else? Okay, that person who just signed in right now, your signal was extremely weak, your audio was extremely low, and I didn't hear it. Would you like to try again, sir? Give me your call letters and your name, slowly, maybe with phonetics. Go ahead. You. I heard Kilo Charlie 9, Alpha Golf Romeo, and quite possibly you're out of the area. Please tell me your name, sir. We'll put you on the list. Please tell me your name, sir. Go ahead. Alpha Golf Romeo. magnitude and close in frequency, 500 hertz apart, according to what you just said.
Or less.
Yeah. Wow. That means with any normal setting of a spectrum analyzer, rarely do we set the spectrum analyzer down to its ultimate resolution if it's a real good one. Some of the real good spectrum analyzers with a scanning filter type will go down to a 10 hertz filter. That's the good news. But by the laws of physics, the spectrum analyzer must scan extremely slowly in order to not give what's called the impulse response. To give the proper response, to the right temporal response of that filter, takes 100 milliseconds or so, that you must dwell on each individual frequency when you're using a 10 hertz wide filter. So scanning is very slow, and if there's any modulation on the signals, life gets difficult. By aiming the antenna in various directions, you can, assuming now the two signals are coming from different directions, you can, by listening to the beat note of the two, when they're 50 hertz or 10 hertz or whatever apart, you're going to hear a beat note of that particular amplitude, of that particular rate, when you're using amplitude modulation, demodulation on the receiver. And as such, the beat note will get stronger and weaker as you aim the antenna in various directions. When you aim the antenna in the direction where the beat note gets the weakest, you know you're emphasizing one of the signals over the other. You're changing the amplitude ratio between the two. So by aiming the antenna until the beat note gets the weakest, and maybe that might be to, let's say, the north, and then you try to make a measurement of how strong that signal is on your spectrum analyzer or whatever other kind of a calibrated receiver you've got, if the beat note is weak enough, then the contribution of the weaker signal is not much of a contaminant. And then the second experiment would be to aim the antenna to the south or southwest, whatever the other direction is, where you emphasize the other signal. And the you'll go through some directions there where the beat note gets strong and then gets weak again as you aim in the other direction. Whenever you can aim in a direction where the beat note gets weaker, you know that at least one of the signals is being emphasized compared to the other. That's one approach. The other approach is using that beautiful piece of equipment that John owns, KC2WGB, called a dynamic signal analyzer. The magic of a dynamic signal analyzer is that it doesn't have a scanning filter. It doesn't have that huge limitation of extremely slow scanning. It is really doing a digital signal process on the signal. It is taking the signal, all components of the signal, gulping it down into one fast-acting analog-to-digital converter, then operating on those digits and then displaying on the screen, sometimes with hertz and millihertz of resolution. It can display on the screen the individual signals with their amplitude. So once you use that kind of instrumentation, you don't even have to worry about aiming the antenna in a direction that emphasizes one and de-emphasizes the other. You can just really make that measurement on that machine. That's the good news. The bad news is it's a rare machine. Not many of us own it. Of the whole group that meets here, John right now is the only guy who's got one. And sometime in the future, we're going to teach each other how to really ring out what that thing can do. I've used that on some very wild experiments at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, which I can describe to you guys someday, and it can do some real magic. That's maybe 20% of the story, but maybe that helps a little bit, Joe. It's a V2RYY, V2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, V2RYY. I was using a service monitor as a receiver in the SSB mode, and I was actually doing what you said, and I was able to beat the signal and actually compare with the internal audio generator to be able to tell the specific frequencies I was looking at. Some were very close to being on center where I expected them to be, and some were as much as 200, 300, maybe 400 hertz off frequency. And say the direction of one carrier would say the azimuth reading of, say, 350 or so. Another one, I approximate.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, I'll be repeating everything that Joe said. The machine did timed out, but during that time, Joe was saying that some of the experiments he's done the carriers were 350 hertz apart. In one case, they were only a couple of hertz apart. And Joe was using his service monitor. A service monitor, a good one by IFR or, I can't think of the other popular brand name. Somebody will chime in with that when they think of it. The spectrum analyzer that's in a service monitor is okay, mediocre. There are spectrum analyzers that have a lot more dynamic range and a lot more resolution. And the so-called ubiquitous spectrum analyzers, the dynamic signal analyzer, the one that runs with digital signal processing. Believe it or not, Joe, that dynamic signal analyzer, that 85, I can't even think of the model number now. John, when John gets a chance to talk, he's going to tell us the model number, because he's got it sitting right in front of him, and he shines it up, and he speaks to it softly and only feeds it cookies and milk. It's one of his favorite instruments. But what I'm getting at is that thing could resolve two signals that are probably 100th of a hertz apart, 10 millihertz apart. That machine, properly said, will completely resolve those two signals, even though they may be 30 decibels different, 1,000 to 1 different in power ratio. That machine will resolve it. That dynamic signal analyzer, what you normally do with that, it goes from 0 to 100 KC, and we're going to be connecting it to an IF strip or something that beats it down. And as such, we get it within the frequency range by some kind of a heterodyning process. But ordinarily, you would connect that to a sound pickup like device, a dynamometer, I can't think of the name of the darn things now, an accelerometer. You would normally connect that to an accelerometer. The accelerometer is connected to your object that's under test. It might be the cabinet of a receiver, for instance. You put it onto a shake table because you're doing what we call a shake, rattle, and roll. You're really finding out whether or not it has mechanical resonance and how many G's of what frequency it can tolerate. And so when your device under test, like say for instance a cabinet of a radio, screwed down to this shake table in a dynamic testing laboratory, and as you sweep various sine wave frequencies, if there was a built-in resonance of your particular cabinet, maybe the upper cover is starting to oil can and move up and down with a resonant frequency, the accelerometer connected to it would see an increase in response. That displayed on the dynamic signal analyzer would tell you right away what is the frequency of resonance, or you could be putting in completely broadband random noise into the shake table. And again, the dynamic signal analyzer connected to the accelerometer, which is glued down with Kodak 910, this cyanoacrylate glue is what they often use for gluing down the accelerometer. Maybe you're going to have one on the x-axis and the y-axis and the z-axis of your cabinet. Any of those resonances will show up as an increased deflection on the accelerometer. It therefore shows up as a voltage that has a particular frequency and a particular power level on that dynamic signal analyzer, which is a kind of extremely high resolution spectrum analyzer. And because it does it in this digital signal processing technique.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because it does that process with the dynamic signal analyzer approach, where there isn't a real sweeping filter, in a small number of seconds it can display all of that spectrum on the screen for you without having to sweep super slow. Because as you use narrowband filters, if for instance your service monitor had to have a super narrow filter that you could scan with it, the scan rate is a function of 1 over the bandwidth squared of the filter you're using, or it's a function of bandwidth squared. So as you go to very narrow filters, you have to scan extremely slowly, and it's a square law function, it's not common sense. So to resolve your signals real close It takes real care, as you can tell. It's a bit of an art form, Joe. Maybe that helps a little bit. The B2RYY for any further questions or comments. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I certainly don't have access to one of those types of instruments, and my HP analyzer does not have that kind of narrow. narrowness in the resolution bandwidth, ultimately, it just can't go down that kind of something that close. Maybe 200 hertz apart, it'll see two carriers, but closer than that, it gets a little tough. Where all this is going, what I'm trying to do is actually very simple. I'm looking at different television carriers I see at the frequency that they produce, the steady state carrier that they produce. I'm looking at those frequencies and rotating the antenna to be able to hear a beat note or a pitch where I can pick up multiple carriers at once. And when I do that, I'm trying to determine what else I possibly could be picking up. With the band opening, that was like 4 or 5 days ago, really good band opening. I picked up one TV station, digital TV station from New Hampshire, confirmed that. Another one I believe I was getting possibly as far up as Augusta, Maine, but I have not confirmed that because there's only...
Repeater, timeout.
I was only able to see the digital identification for a very, very short amount of time. And that's where the other part of the problem comes from. It's a matter of trying to put the antenna in a certain position where I'm rejecting a signal I don't want to see and try to get the one I do want to see. That's the tough part with trying to DX digital TV. Back to you, Dick.
Go ahead, Wesley, with your comment.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you hear me?
Hearing you beautifully. Go right ahead, Wesley.
Okay, N2XGN. I was talking to John. And by accident, I pushed a button on the eBay, and I have acquired 8991A peak power analyzer. What a beauty! I call it machine for penny. And John later on, he find out that he's got one from the early time when he was working with that many years ago. But at that time, his company didn't pay attention to what they buy as long as the job is done. So it is H991A peak power analyzer from Hewlett Packard. I wonder if you would be able to add some information to that and eventually with the help of John. And to
Welcome to the Wesley Net. You say something, then Wesley asks stupid fucking questions for 2 hours.
Yeah, I don't have direct experience with the 8991A Hewlett-Packard, but I do know that a number of companies have made ordinary power meters. In the early days, they were done with a bolometer or a hot wire type thing, or in some cases a crystal detector, but the normal kind of a power meter does a fair amount of video integration beyond its RF detecting device in order to smooth out any kind of random noise that's built into the instrumentation unintentionally. So most power meters, in order to come up with an accurate answer, have responses in the time domain on the meter movement, so to speak, of about a second or maybe 2 or 3 seconds. There's another whole class of power meters which have a kind of a sample and hold, or it's called a follow and hold circuit. If you Google the word follow and hold, there's a whole class of analog circuits where in a certain period of time, it's got an operational amplifier or rectifier in the feedback network, and it looks for the peak amplitude of the signal and retains that peak. And so there's a whole class of power meters like that, which are particularly good at looking at impulse-like signals or radar-like pulse signals. See, ordinarily, to measure the power output of a radar, which maybe has a pulse duration of 1 microsecond, and maybe it's putting out a pulse once every millisecond, that would be a 0.1% duty factor radar I just explained. You could, if you want to, make an average power reading and use some kind of a correction factor. Well, I've done that in the past, and the correction factors usually end up with an awful lot of error. A peak sensing meter, and properly used, a spectrum analyzer can do that, and there's a whole class of power meters that do it. And maybe the 8991 is one of those. We'll have to look that up.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
See, what
say something, then Wesley will ask stupid fucking questions for that.
I'm kind of envious of Joe. What Joe is doing, he's got a nice rotatable antenna, he's got some good instrumentation, and he is becoming a digital television DXer. In other words, by aiming the antenna in various directions, particularly this time of year when we tend to get the band openings, when the weather conditions are such that sporadic E propagation and other kinds of long-range propagation occur. Remember the days of old-fashioned analog television, where channels 2, 4, and 5, you would start seeing television stations from as far away as Chicago or Virginia or whatever because of weather conditions. And late May, early June is one of the peak times of the year when that occurs. Now with digital televisions that have a very specific signature of their so-called, I call it the carrier, but it really is the reference signal, 375 KC, I think it is, from the low end of the band. By looking for that very specific reference signal while aiming an antenna in various directions and knowing what the offset is for that particular transmitting station, television station, each one has a characteristic offset frequency. And so Joe is using these as clues as to how far away he is watching digital television. I've got the tower that could do that. I own the antenna that could do it. I own the rotator that could do it. I just haven't put it all together as it hasn't bubbled to the top of my priority list yet. So I'm kind of envious of you, Joe, and he's having a lot of fun with that one. So please tell it. Please come back from time to time and tell us what you're finding out. Let me reverse the order. Ordinarily, Rich into EO would be next. Let me take Jennifer. Jennifer, KC9 Alpha Golf Romeo. Why don't you go right ahead with your question, Jennifer? My name is Dick. I'm K2RIW. You've got it, Jennifer.
Welcome to the party. Eight left. I ask you questions. Both. And lastly,
are you there, Jennifer? Go right ahead right now.
So, I'm plugged in.
He's an S5 instead now.
Yeah, it's good to know. He's quite weak out here. Okay, I'm going to bypass Jennifer temporarily and go over to Rich's question, N2EO, for the time being. Then we'll come back to Jennifer. Rich, I think you're about to ask us some questions about 10 gigs. I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction to the 10 gig ham band.
Is it?
The ham band at 10 gigahertz is one of the widest ones. I mean, right now when it comes to the 80, 40, 20, 17, 15, 10, and so on meter bands, the 0 to 3 to 30 megacycle ham bands, I guess if we added up all of the bandwidth given to us there, it's a small fraction of one megacycle. Maybe it's in 28 megs, we've got 2 megs. So we've got a couple of megacycles of total bandwidth below 30 megacycles. And if you're progressive enough to decide to use the X-band ham radio band, the band at 10 gigahertz, we own or we have primary use of, from our point of view. We're listed as a secondary user, but there are very few other users there. For all practical purposes, we, 99% of the time, we have complete use of the 10,000 to 10,500 meg band, 10.0 to 10.5, 500 megacycles of bandwidth. Think about that. If you want to do real high-speed data transmission, real high-speed video and pictures and combinations and whatever, that's the band for you. Does that band have bandwidth? The wavelength is approximately 1 inch. So an antenna, a half-wave dipole at 10 gigahertz, is half an inch wide. And I've talked to people in 10 states on 10 gigahertz where the antenna was a 2-foot diameter dish, all transistorized transmitter and receiver, a 2-foot dish. Yes, it was mounted on 100 feet of power, and yes, the tower is on 300 feet above sea level land. You got to get above the trees on 10 gigs. Well, you got to be at a waterfront, a mountaintop or whatever to really propagate that signal correctly. But let me drop. I've talked to hams on in 10 separate states on 10 gigs from my house, and I've never used more than 0.2 watt, 200 milliwatts of transistorized power. I could have run the whole thing on flashlight batteries, transmitter and receiver, if you know what I mean. The 10 gig transmitter and that 2-foot dish with a solid state electronics are sitting in a small box, about a half cubic foot box behind the dish, and it's on top of the tower. And I would talk to it by sending 12 volts up to it to turn it on, and to push the talk switches down in the shack, which makes it go from the transmit mode to the receive mode. And it's a so-called tunable IF system. In the shack, I'm using my ordinary 2-meter receiver in the single sideband mode, because most of the time I was transmitting single sideband. I transmit 144 megs, a few milliwatts of it, up a cable to the electronics in the box behind the dish. The electronics takes a 144 megacycle signal, mixes it with a 10.224, I think it is, gigahertz, and out comes 10.368. So there's an oscillator and a mixer in the electronic box behind the dish, and so the signal I send up the tower at 144 megs gets translated into 10,000 megs, gets transmitted, 200 milliwatts of it, and the receive process will reverse the whole thing. So the real tunable IF is in the shack with me. If I was sending 10 gigs up the tower, the waveguide or the transmission line would have tremendous loss. I'm only sending 144 megs up the tower. The actual 10 gig signal is only going through a couple of inches of cable between the box and the feed horn of the dish. That's the way it worked. Worked like a charm. And my best DX is 380 miles. A guy who was on, he's using a dish on a tripod on the beachfront in Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. And that took place, 8 or so years ago when I was really active on that band. The 10 gig band has a band open.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As you go up higher and higher in frequency, you would assume that the range you're going to get is going to be smaller and smaller. You would assume that the signal travels more and more like line of sight. And that Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, I guess that was, let me think now. My radio horizon is about 40 miles out. It was 8 or 10 times beyond my line of sight is that signal. As long as you live within 200 miles of a major body of water, like the Atlantic Ocean or like Lake Michigan or whatever, if you're within 200 miles of a major body of water, the history shows that you get a band opening every single 24-hour day on average for some number of hours during the day, particularly beyond midnight in the summertime when as the earth cools off and you get dew on the grass, what really means you're getting a layer of moist air down low, drier air up higher. The beauty of moist air is that water has a dielectric constant of 81. Therefore, the radio signal at 10 gigs going through those layers of air close to the ground gets a downward bending phenomenon. And when the downward bending follows Earth curvature, as it does almost every night beyond midnight, if you live within a seashore somewhere and you got the local high humidity air running around, this downward bending, when it follows the Earth curvature, the guy 300 miles away or 400 miles away or 50 miles away sounds like he's in your backyard, even though he's running milliwatts of power. Some of the guys I've talked to on 10 gigs were only running a few milliwatts, just a mixer going into a feed horn is all they were doing. So it's a fun band, but you got to have a local group. Let me drop. You have to have a local group of enthusiasts. There's an agreed-upon frequency. The calling frequency is 10.368.1. Like every other microwave handband, you go 100 kc above the normal frequency that everyone declares as the low end of the band, so to speak. And that's where people will call each other. They also use 2 meters as a feedback or as a liaison. 144.260 is the agreed-upon frequency for the whole East Coast, and the West Coast has another frequency, I think it's 350, but we use 144.260. You go there during a 10-gig contest, which is held in August and September, and guys will get on the 2-meter band, on single-side band, saying, I'm located at the Pacmanatnick Mountain in New Hampshire, and I'm scanning the 10 gig band. Does anybody would like to talk to me? And you first tell the guy on 2 meters, yeah, I'm ready to go. I know where you're located. I've got my 10 gig dish aimed at you. I'm running key down right now. Go look for my carrier. And you start, in other words, you use the 144.260 as a liaison frequency to line up the contact. And then once both guys are hearing each other by way of the feedback on 2 meters, that they're hearing each other on 10 gigs, then the real 10 gig QSO takes place, where they send call letters and a signal report and a grid square location, and that's a contact. And there are times when the 10 gig band, when you're on top of a mountain like at Mount Washington, New Hampshire, quite often, because the 10 gig band has a band opening and the 2 meter band does not, sometimes you reverse the process. Sometimes you literally call CQ on 10 gigs and talk to each other. Now, the one other thing that Rich wanted to know about is waveguide, and John wanted to know a little bit about this too. Everyone thinks that traditional waveguide must be rectangular. Yes, that is the tradition. Let me drop. And the advantage of properly designed waveguide is that the width-to-height ratio is almost always 2-to-1, the inner dimensions. And when you study what happens with waveguide, the signal really goes down there, even though there's no center conductor. That signal thinks it's in free space. It's like when you look at a 45-degree angle down that barber shop, and they've got mirrors on both of the long walls, and you see the barber five times as a reflection. That signal going down that waveguide looks exactly that way, so to speak. It zigzags back and forth between the narrow walls. And the advantage of rectangular guide is that there's only one way the signal can bounce across a particular frequency region, that the waveguide is designed for, and that's a 2-to-1 frequency region. The lowest frequency where the waveguide works well and the highest frequency where it works well is approximately a 2-to-1 frequency region, and that's because the width to height of the rectangular guide is 2-to-1. The next higher mode that gets confusing when you go up in frequency is now the signal starts bouncing up and down across the broad walls instead of the narrow walls. And so that's the next mode of propagation, which has a slightly different velocity of propagation. And if you didn't know about that, it'll seem a little bit confusing at first. Let me drop. But the 10 gig signal itself doesn't give a darn whether the waveguide that it's sending, you're sending that signal down, is it round, elliptical, square, double ridge waveguide, whatever. It almost doesn't care about the shape. Human beings do, because we like to calculate what frequencies will go down there with what velocities of propagation. The round water pipe, 3/4 inch water pipe that you get out of Home Depot or Lowe's, is a beautiful piece of waveguide. It has considerably lower insertion loss than the best stuff you can buy from the Andrew Company. Mil-spec, dry nitrogen-filled, silver-plated waveguide, WR90. That's the waveguide that's made for the X-band frequency range. WR90 means waveguide rectangular 0.9 inch. That's what WR90 stands for. It's rated in hundredths of an inch. And so WR90 works between 8.4 and 12.4 gigs is the rated frequency range. It goes all the way down to, I think, somewhere down to like 6 gigs and up considerably higher. You can use it. Anyhow, the round waveguide that you buy out of Home Depot has lower loss than that. That's the good news. The bad news, the frequency range over which it has only one signal technique that the signal can propagate down there is a much more narrow frequency range. I think it's like a 30% frequency range instead of 100% frequency range. But since the since the 3/4 inch waveguide that you can buy at a Home Depot works so extremely well, the 45-degree elbows, the 90-degree elbows, the coupling devices, the devices that adapt between 3/4 inch and 1 1/4 inch is a feed horn. So when you're looking at all of those copper components, plumbing components that you got in your Home Depot store, let me drop. If you're smart enough, every one of those is a beautiful piece of waveguide that you can buy for pennies, or maybe a dollar, but you know what I mean. A crafty guy with tin snips and a tin can, or the copper components you can buy out of a plumbing store, You'd be amazed if you're smart enough what you can do with those things. You can make slotted lines and trombones and right angle bends, E-plane bends, H-plane bends, feed horns, transmission lines. There are a number of hams who ran 3/4 inch water pipe up the side of their tower as waveguide. It's got around 4.5 dB of loss per 100 feet. If you weren't using the tunable IF technique that I mentioned earlier, which works a little bit better, if you want to have the whole transmitter receiver in the shack with you, and you're willing to live with transmission line loss of 4.5 dB per 100 feet, then the 3/4 inch water pipe would do the job beautifully for you. That's a thumbnail sketch of some of the things that are on the 10 gig ham band. You don't get a nosebleed when you go up that high in frequency. The really progressive guys are going there. And you don't get on there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and call CQ. You might not get an answer. It isn't that popular yet. But with guys like Rich starting to populate this and starting to create a brand new wave of enthusiasm in the New York City area, it's just a matter of you properly advertising it, Rich, and creating a group of guys that are doing it. As has taken place in little pockets of New Jersey and Chicago and Texas and Florida and Los Angeles and San Francisco, there's pockets of 10 gig activity in each of these major areas. Certainly the Boston area has a great big group of these guys. N2EO, go ahead with your further discussions on this, Rich. K2RIW and the TechNet.
I have a question, Dick.
John, recognize. Let's see if Rich is there first. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Yes, it's very, very interesting, and it gives me some encouragement, because I'm sure you got that link to that transmitter I ordered from Fair Radio Sales with the Klystron. They say that Klystron runs about 5 watts. Is that going to... I bought the pig in a poke because it was $99 plus shipping. I figured I'll take a chance. What is your opinion of tuning that thing down, the sideband on 10.368, Dick, and coupling? That was my plan, to couple it into water pipe and make a home station on 10 gigs.
Now, the word Klystron usually is a velocity modulator type microwave amplifying device. The word Klystron itself, just like the word traveling wave tube, these are kinds of amplifiers. Maybe you bought a Klystron-like oscillator, though usually the oscillators are magnetrons. A Klystron could be an amplifier, could be an oscillator. Can you tune it to your particular frequency? We'll have to find that out. Don't know the full answer on that one yet. Right now, the popular way of getting there is by way of, is it SSB Electronics, I think it is? Also, Down East Microwave sells a beautiful converter that's very popular, as is a guy in Germany. I can't think of his call letters and name right now. But CUNY Electronics. CUNY Electronics in Germany. SSB Electronics, I think it is, in the United Kingdom. And Down East Microwave are three of the very popular brands of various kinds of 10 gig ham radio equipment. Now, there's an awful lot of surplus equipment out there that can be converted, particularly Ma Bell type 10 gigahertz or close traveling wave tube assemblies. I own a few of those, which run in the vicinity of 10 watts. And the nice thing about a traveling wave tube assembly is that some of them have got 30 and 40 decibels of gain in one stage, with numbers like 3, 5, 10, and even more watts of power output capability. So traveling wave tubes are really beautiful things. Klystrons tend to be much more narrowband as an amplifier or as an oscillator, tend to be a lot more narrowband. So I ain't got a real answer for you yet, and if you sent me a URL or something to look up, maybe I didn't get that yet, Rich. John, you had a question, probably about waveguide, I'll bet you. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I do, Dick. KC2WGB. When you're putting the copper pipe together, would it not be better to use a hickey to make long radius bends rather than right angle elbows? Does that, they work okay?
Yeah, good common sense. When guys use a rectangular waveguide within the desired frequency range, there is only one particular way the signal will go down there, only one particular polarity. If I had a rectangular waveguide and I lay it on the table with the broad wall parallel to the table, broad wall down, I'm laying the waveguide on the table as low in center of gravity as I can get, if you know what I mean. When I'm doing it that way, the signal will be vertically polarized. No other polarity will go down there. And the signal goes down there, even though you don't know it, it is going down there like a pair of scissors. It is wiggling back and forth, left and right, between, it is bouncing off the narrow vertical walls. So, in the case of rectangular waveguide, the method by which the signal goes, the exact angle at which it bounces, which is a function of wavelength and the size of the waveguide and the polarity, are strictly determined, and you can't change it. You can try as hard as you want, you can't change it. It either goes that way or it doesn't go. When you go to round pipe, the good news is the stuff is cheap as all hell. The good news is the stuff has extremely low loss. The bad news is it has no favored polarity. You can take a vertically polarized wave, putting down a round piece of pipe, and because of a slight ellipticity ratio that your eye doesn't even see. With your calipers, you slowly roll the pipe with your calipers, and you'll find out that the pipe is 2 millimeters higher than it is wide, if you know what I mean. That slight ellipticity of the pipe will slowly rotate the polarity of the signal, and the possibility exists that you launch a vertically polarized wave into the round pipe down here. At the top of the power, it arrives horizontally polarized. It slowly twists. So now when you use your hickey, you are definitely distorting the pipe in such a way that it becomes elliptical in cross-section. Therefore, the polarity will favor a
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Therefore, the signal will favor a particular polarity because of what you've done with the ellipticity you've created with your hickey. So, can you use the hickey? Without a doubt. And you've got to be smart enough in the way you do it. What a lot of guys will do with round pipe is periodically they will put a vertical piece of sheet metal as a septum in the pipe, which forces a particular polarity. If I had a horizontal thin sheet of metal going right across the pipe between the 9 o'clock position and the 3 o'clock position, and it extends down into the pipe, let's say 1 inch, that septum will force pure vertical polarization because that chunk of sheet metal is a perfect short circuit to horizontal polarization. It is a perfect open circuit to vertical polarization. So by putting periodic septums in the pipe, I am predetermining and forcing a particular polarity. By way of your bending with a hickey, you can also favor a particular polarity, and if you're smart enough, you can use that to your advantage. So is it better to do that or to use 45-degree elbows or 90-degree elbows? It's like saying, would I be happier with a blonde or a brunette or a redhead? Each has advantages and disadvantages once you understand the theory of operation. Maybe that helps a little bit, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good explanation like that. By the way, if you put that plate in and you have it in a horizontal position and say 10 foot down the line you put one in the vertical position or an adjustable one, does that become an attenuator?
The way you make attenuator, John, is that you make that plate that I described out of a resistive card. You take a piece of printed circuit board where you've made it out of carbon granules, so to speak, or it's a wedge of carbon. And when the wedge of carbon, which is thin, is horizontally positioned between 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock, and you've got a vertically polarized wave, it'll have no effect. As you start rotating it so that it no longer goes from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock, but goes from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock, I'm starting to rotate the carbon resistive rod, card, into the same polarity as the signal, and it will start becoming an absorber. So one way of making a variable absorber is to rotate a resistive card like I just described. When you do it with a sheet of metal, the sheet of metal is not absorptive. It's a reflecting device. So now you're really building a tuned filter, if you know what I mean. When you've got two reflections spaced a certain distance along a transmission line, you have built a bandpass filter or a band stop filter. You're getting various reflections between the two, but you're not getting absorption. By the way, when it comes to making absorbers in waveguides, oh boy, is that easy. The best way you can make a dummy load is to start off with a piece of wooden dowel that's the right diameter, 3/4 inch outside diameter. Sharpen it like a pencil into a sharp point. Shove that down the end of the pipe at one end with a coupling at the input end so that the signal starts seeing the sharp point. The wood itself has a little bit of moisture in it. Moisture is very absorptive at 10 gigs. And as such, a short distance of that dowel that I just described, probably 4 inches long, becomes a perfect absorbing device with a reflection coefficient of around minus 30 decibels. And it will probably have 40 decibels of insertion loss as to the signal that feeds through that wooden dowel. Some of the very simple things you own, you'd be amazed the various ways that can be used in the microwave world.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You'll be amazed the various ways they can be used in the microwave world once you understand this. Go ahead, Rich, N2EO. We can't spend too much time because we got to go to at least one more person before the mailbag. N2EO, K2RIW.
I just wanted to clarify. I sent you a link. By the way, thank you very much. You gave me a very good overview. You cleared up a lot of things for me. This piece of equipment I bought, I sent you a link. Maybe you didn't get it. Maybe it went into your junk folder. It was made by Hughes as a Hughes aircraft. It cost me $99. It's a power supply, a 5-watt Klystron, and a transmitter. The ad from Fair Radio Sales says it's some kind of a high-level mixer. It said it takes 50 megahertz to 450 megahertz and converts it up to 12.75, I think it is, to 13.25 gig. It specifically says it'll run sideband, and it was used in cable TV heads. I took a shot at it. It was $99. The whole thing weighs about 100 pounds, about $40 shipping. The Klystron is putting out about 5 watts. Back to net, N2EO.
Yeah, the 100 pounds is not easy to tolerate nowadays, Rich. In the old days, 100 pounds of equipment for microwave was pretty tolerable. Nowadays, most of the mixers and translators and local oscillators and things like that we buy rarely go beyond 2 pounds, and rarely do they require more than 20 volts at a fraction of an ampere to operate. So you've got an older piece of equipment, it's made for the so-called CARS band, I think it's called, at around 12 to 13 gigs. And can it be moved down to a lower frequency? I think the answer is most likely yes, now that I know a little bit more about it. So usable, and the price is fairly nice. I think a Down East microwave transverter, I am guessing they're in the $300 category these days, but I'm not absolutely positive on that one, Rich. Okay, we're going to move on because you said you've got an introduction. You've heard 5% of what you'd like to know about 10 gigs. There's a lot to be learned, but a very educational process, as you're about to find out. Let's see if Jennifer is available now. KC9 Alpha Golf Romeo. Jennifer, go right ahead if you can hear me. K2RIW, my name is Dick. And maybe Jennifer is not available right now. Paul, you said you had a quick question, and maybe it was about waveguide, but maybe you've got another question. Like I said, Paul, and then John. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, you may have to wait till after Mel. My question is, last week you touched on a subject about a radar with continuous wave and interrupting that wave, and I had some questions about that, so maybe you want to wait till after Mel.
Yeah, the majority of radars run in the pulse mode where, for instance, they might transmit as much power as possible, quite often some million watts of power, but only for 1 microsecond the radar is on, and then for the next 999 microseconds, in other words, if a 1,000 pulses per second is their repetition rate, for the next 99.9% of the time, they're in the receive mode. And so that pulse of energy goes flying out into space. If it hits an airplane, if it hits the ground, if it hits a tower, some amount of that signal reflects back, and then the receiver, which is spending most of its time in the receiving mode, receives that echo, rates the amplitude and the time delay. Time delay tells you how many miles away is the echo. Amplitude tells you how big is the target. And the radar people rate the target not in square feet that your eye sees, but they rate it in square feet or square meters that the radio signal sees. So they know how much echo they would get from 1 square meter target. That's called radar cross-section. So what the radar signal sees versus what your eye sees is rated in size in radar cross-section. Okay. The majority of radars are the pulse type that I just described. There are a small percentage of radars that are so-called CW radars. The height finder radar that's used on aircraft in the old days, and the radio frequency identification device, a tag reader, a interrogator or reader, is another kind of CW radar. Let me drop. So that if, in the case of a ground-based CW radar that's used for guiding a surface-to-air missile, quite often it consists of 2 separate parabolic antennas side by side, carefully engineered so that the 2 antennas are highly isolated from each other radio-wise. One of the dishes continuously transmits a signal, which is sort of like a searchlight, that goes out there and lights up the sky in certain areas where you think an airplane is going to be. When the echo from the airplane comes back, the other dish side by side picks up that echo and rates its amplitude, polarity, and whatever, polarization characteristics. And so this dual dish CW radar aims itself back and forth in azimuth and elevation until it peaks up on that signal. Or in some cases, it's got a very elaborate system called a monopulse receiving system, where it is electronically determining the angle of arrival of the signal, and it automatically bore sights itself on that target. And when it locks on the target, it says, okay, let's send the missile. And some kinds of missile are called a beam rider, where the missile literally rides up that particular beam until it hits that target and explodes. So there's a whole class of CW radars, and they tend to be much, much lower in power, but because they're on the air continuously, you now have a lot of time to integrate the power out of the receiver. When you study, let me drop. When you study a pulsed radar, the first one I described, common sense would lead you to believe that, well, I take 1 million watts of power coming out of the transmitter, it goes into a dish antenna with 30 dB of gain, I've got 1 gigawatt of effective radiated power, and so 1 gigawatt of effective radiated power at this particular frequency, and free space has got this loss, I calculate a range. You'd be dead wrong. You discover that the amount of range you get out of a radar system is proportional to the average power you transmit, not the peak power. That's the laws of physics of the fact that the receiver is not receiving a pulse continuously. It's receiving these very brief pulses that are only there 0.1% of the time. So 0.1% of the time is the energy you're transmitting. You think you're transmitting 1 megawatt, 0.1% of that is 1 kilowatt. Your real average power, in my example, is only 1 kilowatt. And you've got the range of 1 kilowatt transmitter, not 1 megawatt transmitter. Now when you go over to the CW radar, even though it's running a hell of a lot lower in power, because it's on the air continuously, and you've now got what's called a total power receiver, continuously receiving, and can integrate for long periods of time, it has a hell of a lot more sensitivity. So you don't take the hit in range when you go over from pulse to CW types of radars. However, you've got to be very crafty in ways of making sure that the isolation from your transmitter to your receiver is